Hi, everyone. Once again, I'm Joan Tao. I'm corporate counsel at Syngenta Crop Protection based in Greensboro, North Carolina. And what I'm going to be talking about is, of course, the subject of the day, university-industry collaborations. And I guess we refer to them as generally collaborations with centers of influence to include those entities that may not fall perfectly in the university category, institutes and government organizations and whatnot. Let's see if I can get this to work here. Just briefly on Syngenta, hopefully the company is familiar to you already, but I just wanted to highlight that I guess one thing I guess that makes us somewhat unique from our competitors is the fact that we do have this sort of three-pillar based business. Of course, we're in the agrochemicals area and offer a broad range of leading crop protection products, including herbicides, fungicides, and insecticides. We also are in the seeds area, seed products include field crops, sugar beets, as well as vegetables and flowers. And then finally, this third pillar of professional products for all these other areas that are listed here. And in fact, we're actually evolving this third pillar into something called the lawn and garden pillar into the future, which will include not only chemical products, but also genetics and flowers. And really trying to push forward an integrated offer between the different technologies that we have expertise in. The second bullet point there is just that we are truly committed to innovation and commercializing that innovation. Just to put a dollar figure on it, Syngenta spends more than $700 million per year globally, nearly $2 million per day on research programs, and has more than 400 development agreements with universities and other research organizations. I'm happy to say that even with the economic downturn, my understanding from senior levels of management is that that number is not changing. Luckily, this industry has demographics on its side, if you will. The demand for food, fuel, and fiber is not going away. I just had a few slides here that, of course, actually build quite nicely off of the other presenters. I just wanted to sort of highlight a couple of the trends that, of course, affect, our industry. And, of course, the rapid adoption of the GMO technologies, I think, affects not only directly the seeds business, but also the chemicals business, because we have to start thinking about, what technologies we're really competing against and how to, as I was mentioning before, start to present integrated offers. And this chart, I think, hopefully you can read it, really demonstrates quite dramatically in these major row crops. Oh dear. The levels of adoption over the last 12 years. And it's to the point where in all of these areas, soybeans, cotton, corn, over 50% of the acres planted in the US are now GMO. Okay, sorry, this will be. This was it's a roadmap, and I won't dwell on it too long, but I'll just try to get all the pieces up here. But it was also just a bit of background, and it's been touched on already by others who've spoken. But just I just wanted to sort of lay out the web, if you will, of different regulations and concerns that you have to navigate as you bring a product to market. Of course, you've got FIFRA and the Section 3 registration process. You have other statutes. You have to worry about Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, endangered species. You have to think about state registrations, new uses, and the other items listed on the slide. And also just another sort of set of facts and figures as background. You know, the base data set for conventional pesticides are as follows. You have an enormous amount of studies that you have to do. In all, something like 150 studies. And of course, some of our other speakers have mentioned that the number of years to develop a product is at least in the range of 5 years. So anyway, I guess this is all just to say that, you know, as a manufacturer, given these challenges, of course we look to partner with universities, both as an engine of innovation and also for the pure manpower it takes to accomplish some of these things. Now, I hope you'll forgive my very simple schematic here, but it kind of helps to frame up, I hope, the types of research that, or the types of relationships that we tend to have with COIs or generally universities. They generally fall into three differently sized buckets, as you can see here. And you know, I've kind of tried to pull out some pictures to sort of represent percentages here. But the majority of the work that we do is on an unrestricted grant basis. The gifts that were referred to in the other presentations, and then on not quite as large a level, we are also participating in partially sponsored projects where we do actually enter into agreements with the university or the COI, and usually request some ability to delay publication or review, or and have the ability to file patents in advance, and potentially to have some level of IP rights or licenses. And certainly in the fully sponsored scenario, my little pink bucket there, those are the situations that are not quite as common, but are becoming increasingly common, where we really are very concerned about the IP, and we are very willing to support the research financially, and also to cover overhead costs. And of course, naturally, would like to have as much as many intellectual property rights and control over publication timing as possible. This just sort of in a chart kind of lays out, you know, I guess in a matrix, I guess, what I just explained here. So once again, in the unrestricted grant situation, we're contributing some expenses to research being conducted. You know, we're not really looking for IP rights. Usually, in these cases, it's you know, where we're pretty far down in the research and development continuum, and we are wanting to put the chemicals into people's hands so that you have familiarity with the product and can advise growers. And so we are not so we're happy to do that and support that kind of work. And then also, you know, we actually want to encourage publications, so we certainly don't ask for any restrictions there. And then once again, in the partially sponsored and fully sponsored situations, we are probably further back in the research and development continuum and looking for partnering relationships. So this is just sort of a, you know, we've done some thinking internally about, you know, how we have been handling relationships with COIs and how we, you know, what aspects of it have been problematic or less than optimal. And I think what, you know, internally what we've seen is that we have, as I kind of started to suggest earlier, we're increasingly realizing that the work that we do with COIs may be of a nature where intellectual property and publication will be a concern for the company, and that perhaps we've been confusing what really should be silver and pink bucket work, if you will, for green bucket work. We also encounter bottlenecks within the company in terms of decision making and allocating funds, and also, I guess, vis-a-vis universities in terms of trying to get agreements in place when we have decided that that was the appropriate path forward. We've also had, unfortunately, until now, a bit of the challenge of a multinational corporation like ours, and one that has different arms and different affiliates with different concerns, is that you do have different interests. Like, of course, Syngenta Seeds is a separate entity, and Syngenta Crop Protection is a separate entity, just to give you one example. Sorry? Was there a joke there? Anyway, we've had our tensions because the companies obviously have differently focused interests at times. And, just to give you a little example of issues where, perhaps we may be, we being Crop Protection, Syngenta Crop Protection Inc. may be contracting with certain entities, we may not have been fully contemplating our affiliates' needs and their particular sensitivity areas, like this GMO regulatory requirements note that I've put on here. That's just to give you a flavor. So this is just sort of an aspirational kind of a slide, I guess, if you will. We, of course, want to optimize our relationships with centers of influence. We would like very much to get written contracts for the silver and pink bucket work that I talked about with universities. We really want to push for some sort of broadband efficiency so that we're not reinventing the wheel every time we have a new project. And we're really making an effort with our affiliates to sort of coordinate our interests and talk together about how we might be able to present one face to the centers of influence instead of having sort of multiple arms of Syngenta talk to any particular institution. So, again, I guess as an aspiration, in recent months, we've been talked internally about working toward putting some sort of, ideally, especially with those universities that we do repeat projects with or with multiple researchers within the university, the idea would be to reach some sort of more robust agreement, something like an evergreen master agreement that could contemplate various projects. The real dream, obviously, would be to put in place with the 60-plus universities with which at least Crop Protection, Syngenta Crop Protection, is currently doing work, to have in place this kind of robust evergreen master agreement where underneath it you could have this silver bucket research, pink bucket research, in the form of project plans, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. So the idea would be that each project plan would describe particular work to be done by particular principal investigators and lay out the terms of payment and lay out the expectations. But the general terms regarding publication and intellectual property rights would be governed by the master agreement, so you wouldn't have to constantly revisit those issues. So that would be, that's an aspiration, of course, and it's one that we're still midstream and trying to bring out to our cooperators. And in fact, for those of you who represent the universities, I'd be very interested in chatting with you about your reactions to that kind of approach. You know, curious also about, you know, general issues and potential problem areas and pitfalls to try to avoid with that kind of approach. That's all I really prepared for today, but I, you know, I'm happy to open it up for questions.
Plenty of time for questions.
Yes.
I'm very curious about the master agreement. I don't know if you can relate how many of those you have, your company has been able to put in place. Our company has tried to take that approach with, as far as I know, we have one that took a year and a half to get that set up. What percent of your agreements do you, as the legal representative for Syngenta, get into negotiation or discussion with the legal counsel for individual universities? Do you have any idea on that?
Try to repeat the question.
Sure. Just to repeat the question, I guess was what percentage of agreements are heavily negotiated? Is that a fair?
Right. It's kind of like oftentimes they'll tell the cooperator university rep that I'm working with as well. We get to the point where kind of expect it'll be my lawyer talking to your lawyer. Yeah, I say that facetiously, but no. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, actually, I'll tell you quite honestly, I am counsel at Crop Protection responsible for the research function generally in all sort of contracts and legal issues that arise relating to research. But in the time that I've been at Syngenta, it's been a very sort of one-off kind of endeavor, at least for Syngenta Crop Protection. Because, as I said, most of the work that our research and development function was doing with COIs was of the green bucket nature, and so very rarely it was more the occasional instance where you'd have an agreement which needed to be negotiated with the university, and generally, you know, it would take a period of probably typically 2 to 3 months to sort out all the details and get it finally signed. Increasingly, though, in the last year and a half, I would say that we've seen more and more of those. And I think there are a couple different forces, which I guess I started to talk about earlier, which is one is an increasing conscientiousness internally about the value of IP and in situations where perhaps we've been negligent and haven't been as protective as we should have been. Another reason is that there has been downsizing in terms of our internal capabilities, and so we've had to look to both contract research organizations and to university cooperators to fill the gaps. So more and more we're having to put agreements into place to cover those issues. So it is a challenge, and in fact it's a staffing challenge for the legal department, because previously there was no there was sort of just me on a part-time basis. You know, this is another reason why I suppose there's been this talk about moving towards something like a master agreement, where at least you might have a lot of heavy lifting in the beginning, but the hope would be that you'd have immediate efficiencies after you we're able to get something like that in place, particularly with universities where we do, you know, do something like 70 studies a year.
I'm an independent contractor, and we, I can say we've done a lot of work with many organizations that are represented in this room, but we have some from groups that we've had in place for like 10-year agreements or 5-year agreements, and then periodically they update those. And so this idea of the master plan is nothing new. And the important thing, I think, is to keep a zipper lip when you need the zipper lip, and not to be out there shooting off the mountain, talking about results when you shouldn't be. That's the bottom line. And I think that's one reason we've been successful in my business as a private consultant right next to a major university. We've also seen it, with St. Jeff. Because we can do.
Right. And I'm glad you raised that point, because I mean, I think that is the tension between university industry collaborations, is that the mandate of the university researchers to publish, you know, and to discover, and the mandate of industry is to protect information and to file patents and to gain value for shareholders. So there are times when you're sort of in direct conflict on that particular point and trying to figure out some compromise solution.
I can also see a difference between a private contractor and a university. The private contractor, you know, he's just focused on his job, and so whatever his contract is, he can be restricted.
That's a very good point. And sorry, I just wanted to follow up because you made me think of another point, which is that, you know, we've also had contract research organizations that are really individual university researchers that have provisions in their employment relationship with the university to perform separate consulting work. And, you know, that has been a situation that has been possible workaround, although it does require a little bit of carefulness in making sure that it's very clear to everybody involved what hat the researcher is wearing on the day that they're inventing something. Yes. Right. Typically, for the publication concern, you know, there's some provision that allows the company involved, in our case, Syngenta, to review and to request delay up to 90 days or, you know, some period of time. Usually universities are reluctant to put a whole lot of restrictions on their researchers' ability to publish.
Yeah, and sometimes what they'll
Right. Generally, I mean, the main issue is that because if it's published, then, you know, you've lost your ability in many jurisdictions to gain patent rights. So, you know, usually it's some compromise where we say, you know, we're not going to hold you back from publishing, and we certainly don't want to prevent, you know, students from, or, you know, someone from obtaining their doctorate or, you know, whatever the case may be. But, you know, we have to be protective of the company's interests, especially where we've spent, you know, in many cases, a lot of money for services and work, and need to see value back from it. Yeah, Dave. I haven't seen exactly that, I don't think, but I have seen, you know, certainly licensing schemes where, you know, when you hit certain milestones, that's when royalty obligations kick in, and, you know, that you kind of share the burden or the risk along the way. Does that answer the question? I think some, you know, agreements that I've seen certainly do contemplate all of those, well, various issues and, you know, shifting of risks along the way. I guess it's all, you know, to this concept of net present value. You kind of, you know, everybody has their own, has to make their calculations, and then, you know, you sit down at a negotiating table and kind of figure out, you know, where the overlap areas that we can decide that we can live with. I hope that. Thanks very much.
Thank you.